Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the abomination of desolation when we come back. Well, how many laws did Moses give us in the Mosaic Law? And how many laws has our state and federal governments given us in our secular government? Well, Moses gave us 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, and the state, that is our state and federal government, at last count has given us more than 2.5 million laws. Now, Peter said that we ought to obey God rather than men. He said that in Acts 5, verse 29. And the Congress of the United States said that we ought to voluntarily apply the teachings of the Scriptures in the lives of families, individuals, and society. And our Supreme Court has said that there is a higher loyalty than loyalty to this country, and that is loyalty to God. And they said that in Seeger versus United States. So every authority is in agreement. Our Congress, our Supreme Court, and God Himself. And that is that the Scripture is the final authority on law. Now, if you'd like to learn these 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments and how to use them against government intrusion into your God-given rights, it's a right, it's a duty, it's an obligation that we owe to ourselves, our families, and our society. And here at the law school, we teach all 759 of these statutes, judgments, and commandments, along with the penalties for the violations of these laws. Now, why don't you make it a point to regain your First Amendment right to free exercise this year? The First Amendment is the gateway to the Second, and indeed to your entire Bill of Rights. Now, the law of God is old, but it's not old-fashioned, and it is very relevant to our lives and very relevant to our rights today. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, why don't you go to the website georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for that free General Law CD package. That's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the abomination of desolation, a scientific review or investigation of this very important prophecy, mentioned several times in the New Testament as a benchmark, as a thing to be looking for just prior to the second coming. Now, it was first mentioned by Daniel in the book of Daniel, and it's also tied into this 1,290 days and 1,335 days that we read about, this 3.5 years, 42 months mentioned in the book of Revelation. These prophecies are intertwined, and a fellow by the name of R. Wright, whoever this stranger in the white hat is, named R. Wright, wrote a 4-part treatise called The Abomination of Desolation, an Exegetical Report, copyrighted in 2002 or 2003. I only have the first part of the report. Some listener sent it to me. So if you're that listener, then why don't you call me or send me an email. And let me see if we can get a hold of these other three reports. I think that this one is a dynamite report, the first one. We're on chapter 2 of this first report called Prophecy Perils. And he begins this way. He says, there are two perils to those studying prophecy that we address in this treatise. The first is the problem of accurate dating of events in antiquity, and the second problem is the tendency for prophecy to be understood in the context of the current events that are ongoing at the time that the interpretation is given. Now, either of these can lead to erroneous results, with the ramification that once the interpretation is considered known, then no longer are there people watching and waiting to see its fulfillment. Now, in the case of incorrect interpretation, this means that the real fulfillment, whenever it occurs, past, present, or future, will go without notice, and any encouragement that it might have or might have provided will be lost. So let's briefly examine each of these pearls. Date setting, number one. In general, it's not always possible to be certain of dates in antiquity. Different calendars were in use at that time, and their adjustments for the seasons were subject to rules that were not always recorded, or at least if they were recorded, we haven't found them today. Record keeping typically took place from the time when a particular ruler came to power or when a battle was fought. But that doesn't always help us determine when an event occurred, since we don't always know when the ruler took power or the battle was fought. Now, it's not unusual for different encyclopedias or different historians to disagree somewhat on dates of events in antiquity, and typically, the older the date, the greater the uncertainty. For example, in introducing the dates for events in the era of the Babylonian captivity, historians are, in general agreement as to when these events took place, and they do not differ by more than a year or two. Some call the fall of Jerusalem in 587 BC, others call it 586, and a few call it 585. Hence, a historian using the date of 586 BC would be considered accurate to within a year by nearly everyone. Now, some dates are known relative to events that occurred in antiquity because written records have survived. Now, both the Babylonians and the Assyrians kept diaries and records of their conquests. Nineveh captured the Babylonian records and took them back to Nineveh, where the Assyrians had amassed a library of some 100,000 volumes. Well, in 1852, this library of the Assurbanipal was discovered at Nineveh, and over one-third of the volumes were still intact. Now, over the next many decades, hundreds of thousands of inscribed tablets were discovered. And it's from these records that we know a great deal about the history and the practices of the Assyrians and Babylonians. Now, this information describes events relative to when respective kings took office. So it is necessary to pin down at least one date to our common era calendar so that we can develop an accurate chronology. And indeed, many have tried to do exactly that. Now, one way to try and pin these dates down to our calendar today is by using eclipse data, because eclipses are mentioned during the reign of Nabopolassar. Eclipses are a fact of nature, and we today can calculate well into the future when they will occur and what part of the world will be affected. And we can also calculate into the past as well and determine when the solar eclipses visible in Babylon occurred. This allows us to pin the date of the referred and referenced eclipse on our common era calendar. The date and events from Nabopolassar's journal on our common era calendar as well. Such dates are accepted as accurate to within 1 year. Some, including Edwin R. Thiel, have even made the claim that eclipse dating provides for near-perfect accuracy, a claim that we dispute since wobbles of the Earth have been discovered that were not known when the eclipse data was interpreted by Thiel in 1950. This method of dating is complex, but it serves to illustrate the difficulty of biblical dating. Now, the difficulty in dating increases when we consider the scriptures pertaining to the reigns of the Hebrew kings. The most famous of the explanations of the reignal years is found in Thiel's work, which claimed the northern and southern kingdoms of Israel used accession year and non-accession year dating at various times and even switched back and forth. It is possible academically for this kind of reasoning to be correct, but even if it is, it raises serious questions as to why people of a common heritage would suddenly, for no apparent reason, change calendar systems back and forth. And not a few historians are skeptical of this methodology, and general acceptance has been elusive. Now, our purpose is not to find fault with various dating explanations, but rather our purpose is to illustrate that the reason why such elaborate schemes have been developed in the first place is because biblical dating is an extremely complex subject. Normally, these nuances of biblical dating are not so important in non-prophetic work, since we're dating events within a small error window of only 1 or 2 years. However, in Bible prophecy, we desire to have an accurate date, or at least as accurate as is possible, in order to calculate the prophetic times and strive for accuracy better than 2 years. And this can be very difficult to do. Not impossible, but very difficult. By using a model wherein we can postulate initial conditions, we can eliminate at least or reduce the chance of error due to biblical dating uncertainties and achieve conclusions that are correct for our model. Then, if the conclusions are viable with our own verifiable history, our job becomes one of verifying the conditions on which the conclusions rest. Approached from this perspective, the key condition in this report is that a day equals a year in the prophecies examined, and if that be true, then we can determine the dates of historical events and work around the difficulties of biblical dating. Now let's look at the prophecy problem. The next prophecy peril we examine is what we have termed the prophecy problem, and that's due to its widespread occurrence. This difficulty concerns the timing of the prophecy. In order for the reader to correctly understand the meaning of Bible prophecy, they must know when the prophecy begins and when the prophecy ends. Yet that's not always provided, and the result is that the reader of the prophecy interprets the prophecy then according to the events that are currently occurring around him. A first century reader of prophecy interpreted prophecy according to the events that were occurring or that had just occurred during that interpreter's lifetime. An interpreter in the third century reading the exact same prophecy interpreted the meaning according to the events of the third century. Likewise, an interpreter in the 20th century reading the exact same prophecy interprets the prophecy according to world events occurring in their own lifetime, the 20th century. Now, when the prophecies do not give a clear rendering of when they begin or end, interpreters tend to identify the prophecy with the events that are current to them in their lifetimes. The inability of the interpreter to identify the time intended for the prophecy is what we have called the prophecy problem. Related to this problem of interpretation is the fact that people tend to believe whatever they have heard first. So a 20th century reader of a particular interpretation will believe it to be correct if it is what has been heard first, even if the interpretation was originally made long ago. The damage caused by the prophecy problem cannot be underestimated. So we will describe later in this report how the prophecies concerning the abomination of desolation have been considered across the centuries. For now, it is sufficient for us to understand that there are several conflicting interpretations. Some people see a fulfillment in the actions of Antiochus Epiphanes in 164 B.C. Others see a fulfillment in 70 of our current era with the fall of Jerusalem by Titus and the Roman legions. Still others see the fulfillment in the 7th century with the Islamic conquest of Jerusalem. Now today, in the 21st century, there are many that see a future fulfillment at a time after a third Jewish temple is built. Each of these interpretations originated with people who interpreted the prophecy according to the times that they were living in, as we will describe later in a later chapter. Those who believe the fulfillment occurred in 164 B.C. are no longer watching for a fulfillment today because they believe that it is already fulfilled. Those who follow the interpretation that the desolating event occurred in the year 70 of our common era are also not looking for any future fulfillment because they believe it's already occurred. If they are wrong, however, they will not understand the true fulfillment when it does in fact occur because they're not watching for one since they believe that it has already occurred. Even worse, since the prophecy does not specify a clear time frame for fulfillment, the fulfillment could occur without people even realizing it. And in the case when it has been fulfilled, the people that are watching for a future fulfillment are deceiving themselves, since prophecy is intertwined with God's overall plan. Waiting for a fulfillment that is not going to occur means never understanding the plan of God correctly. Now, for a Bible believer, not understanding God's plan can be very disheartening. Now, consequently, the prophecy problem is in the lack of details sufficient to understand the timing of when the prophecy occurs, how the fulfillment takes place, and what the significance is. And then the ramifications of this is that as incorrect interpretations are believed and promulgated and repeated, the resulting error muddies any attempt at realizing the real fulfillment when it does in fact occur, or waiting for one that will not occur because it's already been fulfilled. Thus, the prophecy problem is a huge problem, and its ramifications can have a profound effect on our understanding. An example of this impact can be seen with the fascination that people have had with end-time events. Over the past 40 years, millions of people have been lured by prophetic writings, some fictional and others simply misguided, into attempting to identify which world leaders are profoundly evil and what will happen next on the world scene. Such prophetic writings are timely according to the news events of the hour today, but can result in leading people away from God when the expected events do not occur, and they find themselves locked in an end-time prison due to not understanding the timing of the prophecy and because they accepted whatever they heard first. It's what you hear first that you believe. Not only do they risk missing the encouragement associated with understanding Bible prophecy, they are separating themselves from God by following prophecy preachers instead of following God Himself. So let's take a look at the prophecy problem when it's resolved. It should be understood by all of us that God does not cause the prophecy problem. Nor is this prophecy problem caused by the prophecy being incomplete. The prophecy problem is caused by the interpreter's incorrect understanding of the Bible or of his unwillingness to find the understanding from the Scriptures. Now, all Scripture is given by inspiration of God. and is profitable for doctrine, reproof, correction, and instruction. The prophecies that are most misunderstood are prophecies that have numbers in them, and because the numbers are not understood, they're frequently ignored. Our set of internet reports focuses on the prophecies that have numbers in them and provide for their biblical interpretation. One way to know if the interpretation is correct is that the numbers have to be comprehensible, and they must be consistent with all of the scriptures and with historically accurate dating. Now, we examined the abomination of desolation scriptures for consistency with other scriptures and developed an understanding of the numbers given in those scriptures. Scriptures specify that 1,290 days must elapse from the cessation of sacrifice before the abomination of desolation occurs. So if you advocate a particular fulfillment and it does not fit with the 1,290-day description, then your understanding is incorrect. For example, the abomination of desolation could not have occurred in 70 CE since there was no cessation of sacrifice 1,290 days or 1,290 years using the year equals a day interpretation before the year 70 CE. We might be able to understand how a person alive in 70 and seeing the unbelievable destruction of the temple, the mass killing of the Jews, and the incredible desolation of Jerusalem that followed would naturally jump to the conclusion that this is the abomination of desolation. But he would be incorrect. And if people of the period labeled the fall of Jerusalem as fulfilling the abomination of desolation scriptures, and then wrote it down, we might be able to see that subsequent readers across the centuries might declare that the prophecy was true and had been fulfilled, believing that they were and had encountered first. However, we should certainly in our time be able to recognize that it is not the true understanding of the abomination of desolation because it does not fit the scripture concerning its emergence 1,290 days after a sacrifice cessation, nor was there a blessing after 1,335 days described in the scripture. But where is the error? Well, the error is in the mind of the interpreter, keeping in mind that the scripture is of no private interpretation. The scripture must interpret the scripture. Interpreting according the events occurred in the time that they're living in, and the error is also in the minds of subsequent believers who, rather than follow Scripture, prefer to follow the writings of men, thereby rebuking the author of the Scriptures. In other words, the error is with the interpreter and his following. It's not because the prophecy is written to mislead, but rather because the readers skip over what they do not understand or do not have the biblical knowledge to understand or the ability to codeplete it out. While we do not present unfulfilled prophecy in this report, we do note here that dealing with unfulfilled prophecy presents a somewhat different problem. Almost anything can be claimed about the fulfillment of an unfulfilled prophecy, since the interpreter needs only to claim that we must wait and then it will all come to pass as the interpreter claims. There are times, however, when the claims concerning the future fulfillment of a prophecy do in fact contradict the teaching of the Bible, in which case we can know that the claims are in error, For example, is there anything at all in Scripture that would identify that Moses, who already has died, would return as an angelic being who kills mortal humans by breathing fire out of his mouth and then die all over again, just to come back to life a second time? Now, this is the understanding of the aforementioned Christian tales. Yet, we can know now, without waiting for the end times, that such a contention is absurd, because it contradicts the Scripture. Now, if an interpretation of future events does not contradict the Bible, then we might need to wait and see what is, in fact, correct. Readers should be aware that the record of correctly identifying the how and when of an unfulfilled prophecy becomes fulfilled, or when it becomes fulfilled, is dismal. In fact, the author is not aware that it has ever been done accurately. It is for this very reason that the internet reports do not deal with unfulfilled Bible prophecy, and instead review fulfilled prophecy only, which itself provides great encouragement. So let us resolve to understand the prophecy in terms of what the Scriptures specify, as opposed to the interpretations of men. In each prophecy we deal with, there are numerical conditions stated that, when understood correctly, will allow us to know that we have the correct understanding of prophecy based upon history. At least one Bible commentary has made the statement that it is not possible to understand the numbers in Daniel's prophecies, and therefore we should not try. I would contend that is heresy. God put those numbers in the prophecy because when the numbers make sense, we know that we have the correct understanding. Man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. And these numbers have proceeded out of the mouth of God. Now, if we cannot make sense of the numbers in a prophecy, let us resolve to say so, rather than saying that God was wrong, or the prophecy was wrong, or that it will never be fulfilled, or that it is impossible to ever understand them. Remember, a good understanding have all they who do His commandments. Believers who practice the law will have a better understanding than believers who do not practice the law. According to Daniel's scripture, some prophecies cannot and are not to be understood until the end times, and then only by the righteous. And if we cannot understand a prophecy, it may well be because it has not been fulfilled, or it is not possible to understand it yet, or we are not righteous, or we are not wise. Remember, Daniel's prophecy said, "But the wise shall understand." So let us resolve further to identify any conditions that are necessary to advance a prophetic interpretation. We've already commented that the Scriptures must be fulfilled in detail and not to be ignored. Our use of conditions also includes conditions on which a conclusion rests. For example, biblical dating is a difficult subject, but not an impossible one. If we are going to use the numbers in Scripture, then we have to make conversions of biblical dates into our modern calendar. Not because the Bible is incorrect, but because our calendar was not used by God to calculate or to make these prophecies. This requires identifying both when an event occurred historically and what kind of calendar was in use at that time and by who. Then we must know these things before we can work with the numerical conditions that are presented in the Scriptures. So for the purpose of these reports, we have not tried to develop dates ourselves, but rather took them up from an encyclopedia. Even so, there's not always complete agreement in different scholarly works, such as encyclopedias and histories, about when things occurred. For example, did the first invasion by Nebuchadnezzar into Israel occur in 606 BC or 605 BC? It's only a one-year difference, but depending on which year we use, we could incur a one-year error. Another example is the use of the calendar. If Scripture states that something has happened for 430 years, and if that is relevant, would that be 430 years on a 360-day Egyptian calendar, or a modified 360 plus 5 extra day Egyptian calendar, a 354-day Hebrew calendar, a 360-day Common Understanding calendar, a 365-day calendar, a 364-day calendar, or a 365.25-day calendar. There are many calendars that have been used during antiquity. Which calendar should we use? So let us resolve to identify any calendrical conditions on which conclusions may rest. In all areas, let us resolve to identify any conditions, constraints, assumptions, or other factors that are able to impact upon our conclusions. And furthermore, let us demand the same of all those who interpret prophecy. Now, if we rely on Scripture, and if we use the numbers presented in Scripture, if we have a biblical basis for conditions, and then we identify any assumptions or constraints, then we can avoid this prophecy problem. This is because we will not be relying upon interpretations or interpreting according to the time that we live in, but rather we will be relying upon the Bible. We will not be able to investigate unfulfilled prophecy, but we will be able to identify and understand prophecies never before commonly understood. And since we will have conditions identified, our conclusions will rest upon those conditions rather than on the perception of an ongoing current world event or potential future event which we cannot know much about because they are yet future. All right, we're at the halfway point. Let us give you a reminder, and then we'll be back with Chapter 3, Interpretations of the Abomination of Desolation Scriptures, a report by R. White. This is report number 1. Now, you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our webpage, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archive. And it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, economics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. However, the endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications so endorsed or recommended are going to reciprocate, and that's because most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, or you can call the school direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Tonight's report is on the Abomination of Desolation, an exegetical report by a fellow named R. White. Whoever Mr. R. White is. Mr. R. White copyrighted this treatise. It's called The Internet Reports, Report 1, The Abomination of Desolation. If you know where these other three reports are, or where we can get in touch with Mr. R. Wright, or if you have the information or know anything about it, would you please call the Law Hour, an editorial review, and share the information with us so that we can share it with our listeners. All right, we're looking at the Abomination of Desolation, Chapter 3, in the world in Daniel's day. Before we examine the Abomination of Desolation scriptures found in Daniel, the book of Daniel, we quickly review the world in Daniel's time. It was during Daniel's youth that Judah was invaded, with the first intrusion being in 606 BC, when Nebuchadnezzar entered Judah, removed some wealth, and took some captives of the population, including Daniel, and deported them to Babylon. In 597 BC, Nebuchadnezzar returned and took more temple treasures and deported more people from Jerusalem and gave leadership of the Jews in Jerusalem to a Jew of his liking. Actually, the king, the Jew, was a nephew of Nebuchadnezzar. A general rebellion occurred a few years later, and Nebuchadnezzar's armies again came to Jerusalem. And after a siege of 18 months, they burned the temple in 586 BC. They deported a few more people, with the temple in ruins and the majority of the population of Jerusalem either deported to Babylon or in hiding in other lands. There were only a few people still living in Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar placed Gedaliah in charge as governor of Judah, and he told the remaining residents of Judah to go about their lives and serve the king of Babylon, whom he would interface with through the garrison that was left at Mizpah. History records then, until the time of Nebuchadnezzar, the Jews had been sacrificing continuously for 400 years. The scriptures state that after the fall of Jerusalem, people from the northern regions came to sacrifice in the house of the Lord, indicating that the Jews still had a qualified priest and a qualified priesthood to perform the sacrifices. The desire to continue the sacrifices was no doubt very strong, since nobody outside of Jerusalem could have sacrificed there for the past 18 months due to the siege. And now with Judah near desolation, the people were feeling the desire to get closer to God. Gedaliah was assassinated, and finally in 581 B.C., the 23rd year of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar's armies returned and deported the remaining people. Thus, the desolation of Jerusalem took almost 25 years to complete. The sacrifices were brought to a total conclusion. Daniel himself spent the rest of his life in Babylon. Daniel held numerous government administrative positions. Historically, he was considered a great prophet according to Josephus, although he was never trained as a prophet or in a position of a prophetic teacher of the Jews. Indeed, some Jews do not consider Daniel to be a prophet today because his position was as a government administrator, not as a prophet. Now, regardless of how we hold his status today, Daniel did in fact receive some of the most revealing and some of the most difficult prophecies while in Babylon. Indeed, some of Daniel's prophecies are to be understood only in the time of the end, as we read in Daniel chapter 12, and then only by the righteous, the wise, those that are unrighteous, those that are fools, those that are not wise, will never understand these prophecies under any circumstances. Among these, the prophecies concerning the abomination of desolation are of great consequence, but are also deliberately obscured. And if you'll go to Isaiah chapter 28, verses 9 through 13, God himself said, "I will speak to this people with stammering lips and another tongue. I will stutter and speak to you in German so that you cannot understand what I'm telling you." In the New Testament, we read that you should study to show yourself approved, a workman that's not ashamed. It takes work to understand these prophecies. Without clear-cut reference points, it is very easy to misinterpret the timing of the prophecies, and it is for this reason, that only when the numerical references are understood and match the actual historical events will we know if an interpretation is in fact correct. Without understanding the numerical references, the prophecies are written in such a way that they can appear to be in fulfillment at several points in history, which is precisely why so many people have claimed an interpretation consistent with the Middle East situation that they encountered during their lifetimes over the past 3,000 years. There have been many interpretations of the abomination of desolation scriptures across the centuries, as well as in more recent times. We summarize some of those interpretations here, noting that the vast majority of people who are aware of the scriptures believe one of the abomination of desolation interpretations that I will now cite below. Let's see if you believe one or more of these interpretations. Antiochus the Fourth of Epiphanes. One of the most oppressive times in Jewish history occurred during the rule of Seleucid ruler Antiochus the Fourth of Epiphanes from 167 BC to 164 BC, approximately 3.5 years. This wicked ruler virtually assaulted the Jews with the intention of destroying them. During the course of his attack on the Jews, 40,000 Jews were killed and the altar of the temple of God desecrated, preventing sacrifice for about 3 years. The oppression ended when Judas Matthias, along with his sons and Jewish followers, rebelled against Antiochus and drove his forces from the land, providing a brief period of relief for the Jews. Celebration of this rebellion has become a strong Jewish tradition that continues to this day. The events are recorded in the books of Maccabees, written about 100 BC. The author of 1 Maccabees, recording the events of the rebellion and interpreting the events within the time frame of their own lives, virtually declared that this was a fulfillment of Daniel's writing concerning the abomination of desolation. Indeed, the historical account provided does, in fact, seem to closely follow Daniel's writing, including Daniel 11, verse 29, concerning the rise of the Seleucid king and the timing of the sacrifice and its cessation. Although not the specified 1,290 days of Scripture, is close enough that many Jews reading the first Maccabees account believe this indeed is the fulfillment of that prophetic scripture. they do not require that the 1,290 days from sacrifice cessation mentioned in Scripture be exactly 1,290 days, and believe God was only providing an approximate time frame with his specification of 1,290 days. And was that 1,290 days, 1,290 literal days, or 1,290 prophetic days? Even though the Jews do not hold that the Maccabean accounts are part of Holy Scripture, they do accept that the account describes therein, and often even accept the Maccabean author's declaration that this fulfills the abomination of desolation prophecy. So, Jews that have accepted this account are no longer looking for fulfillment of the abomination of desolation prophecy after this period, because they believe that it has already been fulfilled. The 1,290 days mentioned in the Scriptures do not match with history, but without having experienced something worse and not being able to comprehend something worse, there were Jews of that day who believed that the events fulfilled the Scriptures, and because the author of 1 Maccabees wrote it down, and tradition has developed to celebrate the event, this perspective remains strong with the Jews and Jewish people today. It's the first story heard. But is that story correct? It may have seemed to be correct at the time, but since that time, there have been other desolations and abominable actions. In the current era, 70 AD, the temple was not only desecrated, it was totally destroyed, and it remains destroyed to this day. At that time, Jews came in from throughout the region to fight the Romans for the liberation of Jerusalem, and the result was that there was an extension and an extensive loss of life. The exact figures are not known, but estimates of Jews killed hover around 1 million in 70 AD, which is many times more than the 40,000 that were killed by Antiochus Epiphanes. Furthermore, the destruction of the temple of God far overshadows the three-year desecration by Antiochus IV, and since the temple has never been rebuilt, the resulting desolation is many times longer than the short three-year desolation of Antiochus. Our conclusion can only be that the events of the fall of Jerusalem in the year 70 are a far greater abomination and a far greater desolation than that of Antiochus Epiphanes in 164 B.C. We do not believe the abomination of desolation was at the time of Antiochus IV, nor, as we shall see, was it at the time of 70 C.E. either. Specifically, the 1,290 days mentioned in Scripture do not fit the Antiochus IV time frame or the 70 CE fall of Jerusalem, and there was no blessing 1,335 days after the cessation of the sacrifices or 1,335 days after the desecration. Further, Daniel 9:26 specifies that the desolators will come to a sudden end when God pours out his wrath upon them. No such thing happened to Antiochus IV, who survived the events and was driven from the land. Nor was anything that could represent God's wrath poured out on the followers of Antiochus IV. It should be clear that for very scriptural reasons, Antiochus Epiphanes couldn't possibly have fulfilled the scripture of the abomination of desolation in 165 B.C. However, Daniel's scriptures also tell that there will be rebellions, other abominations, and other desolations. It is our position that the horrible times of Antiochus IV fulfilled other less specific scriptures relating to other desolations. It is indeed unfortunate that the Jews have attached the title of abomination of desolation to the events of 167 B.C. to 164 B.C., since such a belief brings a premature closure to the all-important abomination of desolation prophecy. The second one is called the fall of Jerusalem in 70 of the current era. Many Christians do not accept that the abomination of desolation occurred in 167 B.C. because Jesus, who lived nearly 200 years after that time, declared that the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet was yet future to the first century Jerusalem. These people believe that the events of Antiochus the Fourth foreshadowed the time of 70 when they believe to be the proper fulfillment. They cite that Jesus had spoken of a time when Jerusalem would be surrounded by armies and advised that they should leave Jerusalem in the days leading to the battle of 70 CE. That is exactly what the Christians did. As the armies gathered for battle, the Christians fled Jerusalem and they survived. Many of those survivors believed this was the fulfillment of the scriptures concerning the abomination of desolation as described in Matthew chapter 24. Hence, they ascribed the abomination of desolation to have been the battle of Jerusalem in 70 AD. However, this does not fit the scripture. The Christian scripture states that the abomination of desolation is set up in the holy place where the temple stood. But nothing was set up in the holy place during the fall of Jerusalem in the year 70 CE. Instead, the holy place was destroyed. Additionally, the events of the fall of Jerusalem do not follow the scriptures, which cite 1290 days after the sacrifice cessation, the abomination of desolation shall occur. The temple was destroyed, the sacrifices ended, but it did not occur 1290 days from the sacrifice cessation, as scripture requires. Further, there was no blessing 1,335 days or 1,335 years from that time, 70 AD, and as was the case with Antiochus, nothing approximating a judgment of the Romans has ever occurred from that day to this. The abomination of desolation scriptures have simply not been fulfilled by the fall of Jerusalem in 70 CE. Additionally, scriptures citing the surrounding of Jerusalem by armies can be applicable to other times as well, including our time today, particularly the Islamic conquest that we will describe next. The Islamic conquest. Muhammad introduced the Arab world to Islam in the late 500s and early 600s. After Muhammad died, and during the reign of the second caliph, Omar, Christians sent a message to Omar as the Islamic army was advancing against Jerusalem in 638 CE, indicating that they would surrender the city if Omar himself would come to Jerusalem and personally sign a proposal stating item by item what they would be willing to submit to if Omar would spare their lives and not destroy Jerusalem. Hence, Omar came to Jerusalem to sign the pact, which became known as the Pact of Omar, in spite of the fact that Christians had proposed it, seeking to save their own lives. Whereas the Christians in Jerusalem fled the city in the year 70 CE in accordance with their understanding of their scriptures, the Christians in 638 CE did not follow their scriptures, and they capitulated the city to Omar, with the result that the Arab Islamic forces took Jerusalem without a shot, without a battle. There was no loss of life. The Pact of Omar is provided in the Appendix B of this report for interested readers. After Omar entered Jerusalem, his first conquest, or his first request, was to be taken to the Temple Mount, which is now called Haram el-Sharif by the Muslims, and located a large rock that Islamic tradition now believes to be the one from which Muhammad's black-winged horse, El-Barak, leaped into heaven while Muhammad was on a night journey, as described in one of his visions. Omar declared that he would build a dome over the rock. Sophronius, the Christian prelate of Jerusalem, declared it is the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Sophronius died the following year, but his words have lived on across the ages, testifying that the Dome of the Rock is the abomination of desolation. Omar, however, did not build the Dome of the Rock. Omar was assassinated, and his successor was also assassinated, and it was more than 50 years before the Dome of the Rock, or the Dome over the Rock, was built. In the meantime, the Muslims built a large wooden mosque on the Temple Mount site, and they called it the Mosque of Omar. It remained in place for nearly 50 years before it was in need of repair. At that time, the caliph in charge of Damascus, the region in which Jerusalem was located at the time, tore down the wooden mosque in 685 CE, cleaned the site, and in 687 CE began the construction of the Dome of the Rock. It was completed in 691 CE and closely followed by the construction of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, completed in 715 CE. And it should be noted that the Dome of the Rock was built as a shrine to Islam, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque was built as a replacement for the Mosque of Omar previously occupying the site. There are some divisions of Islam that do not recognize the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque as two separate entities, but rather consider the entire Temple Mount platform as being a mosque, and would do so even if there were no buildings there. This has led some Westerners to refer erroneously to the Dome of the Rock as the Mosque of Omar, but this is not, nor has it ever been true. The Dome of the Rock was built as a shrine and remains a shrine to this day, not a mosque. It has never been a mosque, nor was it ever, or has it ever been named the Mosque of Omar, even though it has frequently been called such by those that are uninformed. Sophronius declared the proposed Dome of the Rock to be the abomination of desolation because, like the others before him, he interpreted prophecies in terms of the times that he was living in, not because he had any special knowledge or scriptural support for his statement. That was his belief, and he wrote it down. People believed it. There have always been those who have echoed the statement of Sophronius and called the Dome of the Rock the abomination of desolation, but the number of individuals believing this has never been very large. Sophronius offered no scriptural support, nor did he and did not reference the 1290 days cited in Daniel's prophecy, and he offered no other evidence at all to support his conclusion. So as it turns out, however, given the weight of history, this perspective is worth a second look, and we will undertake that look a little later on in this report. Well, I'm about out of time, and I'm going to have to break off right there, so let me make a mark right here in the margin. We'll be back with more on the abomination of desolation when we return tomorrow night. Let me ask you once again, if you know of Mr. R. Wright, or if you've got any copies of his other reports, report number 2, 3, and 4, I'd like to get those. And we'd like to give some more information and some more credit to Mr. Wright for having written this treatise. It's a scientific treatise using the scientific method on the abomination of desolation prophecy of Daniel and of Matthew 24 for his conclusions. I thought it was worth looking at. All right, you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. All right, that's it. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you tomorrow night, God willing, of course. Same time, same station. So until then, good night, friends.